Exclude podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Happy 2016, everyone, or something 2016. I don't know if happy is the right word.
Yeah, if you're a Syracuse fan, 2016, probably not happy. Then again, 2015 really wasn't too great either. This is pretty much the sequel to 2015, The Reckoning, or name your goofy sequel title. We are not looking good on the basketball court, and that's troubling, Dan. What was your most troubling thought after losing to Clemson the other night?
It's weird, because I tweeted it out after the game, and it's almost like I almost wish that this team would just go and lose like a normal team. And I know that's asking a lot for, you know, a Syracuse fan, but every single time we've lost, which is now six times in, you know, the first week of January, which is terrifying, the team has really ripped the hearts out of the fans, and it's been in every game, and you can see this, you know, little pieces here and there, and we have great performances from, like, one player, but then everyone else doesn't show up. So we know that this team is talented enough to compete, at least with the teams that we face so far. Obviously, we haven't seen Duke or UNC or Virginia or anything. But it's just so frustrating to watch game in and game out, them go into, like, the final timeout with, you know, the game either with a slight lead or, you know, closing a deficit, and then they just fall apart and something stupid happens. So it's just been very frustrating to watch this team lose, and it's very much, you know, it feels a lot like, you know, when you hear about a team that doesn't know how to win. I know last year they didn't win a ton, but they, you know, made some games interesting and had a couple down the stretch. It's just very emblematic of that, which is something that Syracuse fans, up until last year, you know, we didn't have for a while. So I know it's new for me. I'm sure there are people from, like, the mid-90s who will, you know, yell at me for being a recent Syracuse elitist, but it's been very tough to watch.
Yeah, and you know what? I think it's been tough to watch for me, too. And I was someone who did sit through 06, 07, and 07, 08. Sat through some of the 90s teams when I was younger. This is just... You're right. I think it's an inability to conceptualize wins, which is weird because I felt like they did a very good job of it against Texas A&M. I wouldn't consider the UConn game in there, I think. I think the UConn win was a happy accident, admittedly, especially the way they played for most of the second half. I think the A&M win was a complete victory, and no matter what happens this year, I think we'll look back at that as the high watermark for at least for now, anyway, for the regular season. But I think this is a team that there's an impending doom and collapse that I feel like permeates the fan base, and it permeates the team. I think you started to see glimpses of it against Wisconsin, and it's just kind of continued on through this really, really rough stretch under Mike Hopkins. I think in general, you know, it's not, you can't just point to one thing. It can't just be the lack of scoring in the paint or free throw shooting, or you can't blame Hopkins. You can't blame the lack of depth solely. I think it's a combination of factors, and it's also amazing to me, we could talk about this later if you want, just how quickly the fan base is checked out, both in person and online, it seems.
I think it comes from kind of what's going on in the football program. Like, obviously, you know, lacrosse is always pretty good, but that's still a very niche sport, even in Syracuse. So when you have two straight seasons of just bad play, at least, you know, obviously we're coming from very different levels as Syracuse football fans and Syracuse basketball fans. It's almost like people are just checking out of, like, the athletic department, which is unfortunate, just so much good has happened in the last year. But it would be nice to kind of string some victories together in the two major sports, and it's been tough to come by.
Yeah, the two straight years things is a good point. I mean, my sophomore year, 07-08, that was the year that Dievendorf was out for almost the entire season, the year that Johnny Flynn was playing 39 minutes a night, Routen was out for the whole season. And yeah, I think everyone was pretty checked out. I think the NIT game, I might have refused to go just out of protest because as a fan, I was just so disgusted with what I was seeing. But what I was seeing, while it was uninspired in defense, it at least had a lot going on in the offensive end, and that team fought hard more often than not. Well, both of those teams did, the 06, 07, and 07, 08 squad. I think this team is fighting, and they're playing in close games, but the impending doom factor is a new thing for me. I think it's a new thing for you and a lot of other fans, too. I mean, Dan, what do you think it is more than anything else? I mean, like I said, it's not one thing solely, but do you think that one thing is more prevalent in the players' minds as these games go down to the wire and end up being losses?
I think the easiest thing to, the easiest thing to point to is probably free throws, because that's always an issue. And that's certainly something. I think probably the most prevalent thing is just the greater depth issues, because those lead to so many other things. That'll lead to, you know, midway through the game, we stopped getting any rebounds. Obviously, this isn't a good rebound team to begin with, but like, they'll hold their own for a minute, and then the depth issues kick in, and you stop seeing the hustle plays, you stop seeing the rebounding, you stop seeing some of the steals, the legs fall out from under the shooters. So I just think this team was, we knew it wasn't very deep to begin with. Caleb Joseph, totally no showing this year, is a bit of a surprise. Obviously, last year was up and down, but we'd take last year Caleb Joseph right now for sure. Daewon, has some nice performances, and then has some games where he just isn't a factor. Chino is Chino. Franklin Howard's been sick, and he showed some things, but he's still like not quite there. So we're playing with, five guys who we can reliably put on the floor and get probably 30 minutes out of, but one of our starters, and then basically our whole bench outside of Tyler Lydon, who is more or less a starter. You just don't know what you're going to get in a given night, and more often than not, it's not going to be a huge impact. So it's really the depth thing, I think, is the biggest thing, and then I think you can kind of take the rest of the factors from there.
So do you think that it's a mental issue, or do you think it's a physical exhaustion issue? Because obviously it's a young team, but I feel like, again, we've been in this situation before. We've had teams that have had really short benches, and no, they haven't been incredibly successful, but they've managed. And I think, I'm pointing directly to the two, Johnny Flynn teams in particular. That team ran a hell of a lot more than this one does, played with greater pace. By, I think, year two with Flynn, I think the team found ways to play better on the defensive end of the floor. And it just seems like, again, this is me pulling from teams that I've watched and watched very closely, is that I'm not seeing how that team, playing basically five, maybe six guys, was able to run and be much more competitive with better teams at the end of games and play very watchable basketball. While this one, I feel like, plays a much slower pace and simply just can't get it done past maybe the 10-minute mark in the second half.
With the 2008-2009 team, which was my freshman year, that team, none of these Boeheim teams are all that deep. He rarely goes past seven or eight. But that team had a little more flexibility in terms of the positions, because you had Routens, who could fill in at the two. He played a little bit of the three. You had Paul, who could play anywhere from like the two to the four. You had Anjanat, who gave, outside of like a midseason swoon, gave really good minutes at the four. You had two guys who could play the center. So while you only had, your seven or eight, you had seven or eight that could give you minutes in different spots. And you saw the same thing with the 2010 team. So all these teams had these kind of these different lineups that they can throw at you with different looks, and you could, ride the hot hand. This team, you have the five guys, and maybe Daewon will give you a good 20 minutes once every three games, and it's just so limited. And I know, and from what we've read from Michael Burke, who does an amazing job with his lineup pieces and his stat pieces, those five, there's that one lineup, the Lydon center small ball lineup, is by far the best one. And, as much as I'd like to see that lineup play 35 minutes a game, you just can't do that. And we're just not getting anything else from the three, four guys that aren't in that lineup. So I just think it's both shallow depth and limited depth in terms of the range of looks that we can give.
I think that's a smart perspective. I think overall, I think going to the season, you, me, and everyone else really said, okay, things are obviously going to hinge on Benajay, and he's going to be the leader of this team, but, somebody else has to step up. And I think it was one of the questions in the kind of season preview roundtable was, who is the second banana to Benajay? And I think we were kind of split between maybe a Richardson or a Cooney, and it ends up it's neither. Dan, did that ever cross your mind, I guess, going into the season, that a senior year Trevor Cooney would be a no-show in a lot of key spots? And while he hasn't played poorly necessarily. He's definitely taken a step back from last year, which we also considered a step back. Do you think that Richardson, his consistency is off? I mean, did you ever visualize a team that is pretty much last year's team, except it hinges on a guard slash forward instead of a Rocky and Christmas like last year?
I'd hesitate to like totally concede that Tooney's taken a step back, but mostly because up until this last game, he had a nice little stretch. So I think he's just, I think we can all effectively say he's never going to be the consistent player on offense, which is what it is. That's not necessarily shocking. You know, you would think he would take at least a sizable step forward, even if he doesn't become a superstar. And I think that's fair. I think it's more, you know, Richardson, obviously he's having a couple flashes, but he had some no-show games. Leiden's had some really quiet games. I think it's more surprising, like you said, we haven't found that second guy, whether it's Coleman, who obviously has his own issues, which, you know, are largely forgivable, but they're way more enhanced on this team. I think my choice when we had that question was Tyler Roberson, based on, you know, Roberson's weird because his best games don't really coincide with, like, you know, he doesn't light up bad teams. He just shows up here and there, and you don't really know when he's going to emerge. His best games last year were against Duke. But he, like, there are nights, and Hopkins said it last night, he was great yesterday, but there are games where he's just totally disengaged from the game, and you're going to get, what, 5 points and 6 rebounds from him, which is just not enough. But we really haven't found, like, that number two guy. Yeah, occasionally, Cooney will have a nice game. Occasionally, you know, Malachi's had probably the best player on the team for 2 games, but no one's really stepped into that role, which is an issue. You don't know who the go-to guy is. You don't know, outside of Banajay, you know, having the ball in his hands at the end of the game, like, you don't know where plan B is, because it whips around so wildly, and there are moments within games where no one's playing well. So, I think that definitely is an issue. And it's unfortunate, because for the second year in a row, we might end up wasting what is a really awesome senior year from a fun player that we all really like.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point there, and I completely agree with you. I think it'd be a bummer to see both Banajay and Christmas go out without tournament bids. A couple years ago, even during the Final Four season, I think one of the biggest criticisms levied at Syracuse was you don't know who's going to take the final shot, and now we know who should be taking the final shot. I think it's Banajay, but then after that, there's a kind of, you know, just a bunch of shrug faces. Obviously, Syracuse has always kind of shifted its personality, especially I think in recent years. It's really kind of adjusted year to year how it plays basketball, at least on the offensive end. Do you think it's strange? Do you think it's just a sign of the times that you know, SU is now, I'd say, in year maybe 4 or 5 of struggling to pick, like, that guy, that shooter? Who you know 100% of the time is going to be taking that clutch shot?
And we talked about it a little bit today on the back end. Well, actually, it's been kind of a running dialogue, I think, in the Syracuse world here. Syracuse has had a really weird string of roster turnover, outside of, like, the transfers from last year, which, in retrospect, maybe wasn't the rightest thing, but you know, neither Patterson or Johnson were really going to be that guy this year in all likelihood. But, you know, you have Tyler Ennis, who you're expecting to be on the team for 2 or 3 years. Boeheim admitted that, and he's gone after a year, and he was definitely the guy. And then you have Chris Mottola, who we were probably more excited about than anyone since Tarmelo as an incoming freshman. He has, what, like 11 games, and he's gone. So this team hasn't, like, had a chance to naturally build on itself, and it doesn't have that, like, instant refresher that, like, a Kentucky or a Duke does. Like, no one does. Those are the two teams that recruit at that level, and there's no one else that really really compares. There's, you know, a definite tier break. So when you're Syracuse and you're, like, on a second or third tier recruiting, you know, you get your 5 stars and you get these big players, but when they're not allowed to naturally develop into their roles, at least they haven't been for a couple of years, I think we saw that more in 08-09 to, like, the Fab Melo, Deion Waiters team. Those guys kind of shifted up and moved into their spots, and you saw a guy like Chris Joseph go from, like, the guy who would get, you know, into games half the time and blowouts, and then he became, you know, the dynamic sits man on the team after that, and then he became the star for 2 years. Same thing with, like, CJ Fair. now we don't have that because things have been accelerated and we've had just weird movement in the roster. So I don't think we've had that progression on this team in a couple of years.
You know, it's a good point. It's one, you and I were bringing up on Twitter after the game, and we brought up in the back end Slack too. This isn't a recruiting issue, and a lot of people are pointing to recruiting, and it's just that's not the problem. And the problem is talent development. It's not talent. You know, all that really nice run we had from 2009 through 2014 was all based on, based largely on talent development and players sticking around for a few years. And you don't always need a guy to stick around. Sometimes you can have a standout freshman like an Ennis who can step in with a bunch of veterans and have a quality team that looks really good and can be very poised. Right now we just have so much roster turnover, and again, it's going to come off as striking out in recruiting, and it just isn't. It's bringing in a lot of talent, but a lot of talent in waves and sporadic. We've had a lot of big injuries. We've had guys leave early when we didn't expect it. It's not that they shouldn't have. It's that we just didn't expect them to. This is it just so happens that kind of shift in how things have gone recruiting-wise, or at least not recruiting-wise, but talent development-wise, coincided with NCAA sanctions that also, have, two scholarship reductions a year. So I think this just happened to be a perfect storm of just, shitty timing, and that just sucked for us because now, on top of all that, Boeheim is in year one of a possible final three seasons, and that adds another wrench to, and it's not to throw Hopkins under the bus, but it's another wrench to a suddenly very tumultuous time for the program.
Right, and I do think there's a chance this kind of fixes itself. Maybe it's just a quick period here, but next year we have a two-person class coming in of Matthew Moyer and Tyus Battle. I don't think we expect to lose any of the young guys on this team. Obviously, Benajay's graduating, Cooney's graduating. But I don't think, some people are saying, obviously there was buzz on Lydon after Atlantis, but I think we would all right now expect Tyler Lydon and Malachi Richardson to be back next year. And if that happens, then I think maybe it kind of corrects itself because Moyer steps in, he should be able to be a role player right away, and then Battle we kind of expect to be one and done-ish. So it's not really a shock. So then you start to have the depth and the guys who should be able to be number one, number two guys kind of flowing together. And then hopefully this kind of dovetails into a nice end of Boeheim's career. But, it could also totally not work out, as we've seen. But you started to raise the issue of Hopkins. It's going to be interesting to see how it goes here. I almost, for a minute there, right before the Wisconsin game, really, you could have almost, when the team was rolling, you could have almost seen Hopkins steps in, goes 7-2, 8-1, and Boeheim just says, all right, we're good, and retires at the end of this year. Now it's, we really don't know what we have. I think some people are being a little bit reactionary with these nine games. And honestly, if they had gone 9-0, I probably would have said the same thing. We really don't know because it's Hopkins coaching Boeheim's team, not Hopkins coaching Hopkins' team, which is what Boeheim said starting this whole thing. But I don't know. I feel like we're just not used to losing at this level, and it's really kind of setting this fan base into a weird cycle of worry and just a bunch of stuff that we've seen come out on Twitter and in the comment sections and everything. So hopefully Boeheim writes the ship, but it'll be an interesting reaction when or if he does.
Yeah, I think that's great that you brought that up, because it's kind of what I wanted to touch on a little bit earlier, but I was just thinking through how to when to weave it in. And that is not to take anything away from Hopkins, but what do you think Jim Boeheim adds in his return? This isn't to throw Hopkins under the bus about what he did or didn't do, but it's to say, what does Jim Boeheim inherently do and is just so well versed in and experienced in that he can add to this team right off the bat and potentially help at least set them up better for an upset this Saturday against North Carolina?
Just a feel for the game. I don't know that they're outside of the whole debacle with the time of the foul at the end of this Clemson game. I don't think they're super obvious moments of like, oh, Hopkins should have done this instead of this. Like, people who think that they know exactly what substitution should happen at what time are kind of lying to themselves. Like, he probably has a decent idea, but I don't think you can kind of master anything until you've done it. And obviously, we've had Boeheim here for so long. I think he almost made it look too easy, but when he started, it was in a different time, and he was allowed to kind of grow with the game without so much scrutiny and whatnot. So I just think the fact that Boeheim has been around for almost 40 years, like, there's a reason why he's won as many games as he has, and I think he definitely has a natural feel for how the flow of the game goes. And even when people have, you know, gotten mad about the stall ball and stuff, like, there's a reason why, you know, the things that he believes in works and why he sits with them. So I'm not sure if it'll be anything that's like super obvious to us watching the game or something, but like, oh, Hopkins wasn't doing this. And now Boeheim isn't, we're winning again. I just think he probably has a little bit better feel for the team in that role where, you know, Hopkins is around the team a lot, but he's not the one calling the shots on game day. He's, you know, running practice and observing. So hopefully, you know, this will kind of shake the rust off for Hopkins when he does, you know, he's not going to be totally fresh when he does take over. And I don't think anything will change with the succession plan based on 9 games. But I do think the team will probably be I think it'll look better under Boeheim. It just makes sense that it would.
Yeah, no, I'm completely on board with that. And, you know, you brought up some good stuff there as far as, you know, we're a spoiled fan base, and we're not the only one, but we are a spoiled fan base because, you know, this isn't an easy job. It isn't easy to do what Boeheim's done, and a lot of the media might throw some shade on how it's been done or you know, the way in which in general. Like, there are a lot of different criticisms levied at Boeheim and Syracuse, and you know what? Some of them may be warranted. Most of them, though, aren't because most of them are made to, you know, diminish the accomplishments of a 40-year career that's largely based in, you know, a ton of success. I mean, no, we haven't won at the same rate, especially championships-wise, of a, you know, Mike Krzyzewski or you know, Roy Williams maybe, but we've won at a rate that doesn't make any sense to 99.9% of other fan bases, and that shouldn't just be glossed over. And you know, Sean and I talked about this on a random like one-off podcast, I think like 2 years ago, and we're saying like the day. Like, when we finally become just like everybody else, where we have a coach who is there for his contract, and then we see what happens next, that's going to be, you know, it's going to be a very, very weird time for Syracuse fans, and there's going to be a lot of meltdowns. And I think we started to see, we had a unique opportunity to see a glimpse of it for these last 9 games, and I really didn't like what I saw from the fan base overall. Just because it was exactly what Sean and I were looking at. And I know you've said it and others too, like the fan base psyche just went off a cliff in a month. And it was because we had this idea that everything just continues as it was and that, you know, and that this is what college basketball fandom is all about. And like, you know, I'm only speaking from the standpoint of a Syracuse fan and one who's been one for my, you know, most of my life. Duke fans will go, this isn't just a hate on our fans, like Duke fans are going to go through probably the same thing at this point when Coach K eventually hangs it up. Like you can't just automatically assume that Hall of Fame coach begets new Hall of Fame coach begets new Hall of Fame coach and that everything stays the same. I don't think we live in a world anymore, at least from a college basketball fan or college sports fan standpoint, where you're just going to have the same coach for 40 years. I mean, Sean said it, we've all said it before. Like, this is not what we know to this point is not normal. It was barely normal when he, you know, was doing it and still is doing it. And it's not going to be normal when he's done. And I think that's something that the fan base, you know, has to keep in mind a lot over the next few years. And then as Hopkins takes over that, you know, you can give him a lot of rope to play with, but also, you know, it goes both ways. Give him a lot of rope and don't just throw him under the bus because he's not Boeheim, but also don't give him so much rope that no matter what he does, he's a god, because I don't think that's the proper way to view it either.
That's right. And I think it's funny because we all know there's like that section of Syracuse fans who no matter what happens with Boeheim, like he can't ever do anything right. And a section, I mean like, a handful of people that are allowed on Twitter, on message boards and whatnot. It's not anywhere near like even a plurality. But there's like those people who just, for whatever reason, just hate Jim Boeheim. And for like the 99% of us, we've seen Boeheim wildly successful with a national championship and a bunch of conference titles and Final Fours and everything else, where it's almost like with Hopkins, he has this 9-game stretch where he goes 4-5, which, you know, a fairly rare thing for Syracuse basketball, but this team also doesn't appear to be all that good. And it's almost like everyone else who is great with Boeheim and loves him, like, we're so unused to, you know, mediocrity for even a couple of weeks that we all turned into like the anti-Boeheim people. But with Hopkins, who, you know, again, is not coaching his own team. He didn't have, you know, months to prepare, and he didn't have his own, you know, recruiting strategies. And you know, I think Hopkins even said when he takes over, it's not going to be an exclusively zone team. Like, this is not going to be what the team looks like under Hopkins stylistically. Maybe he's this bad, maybe he's incredible, but we really don't know based on this stretch. So hopefully we all take a step back. Hopefully Boeheim, I'm sure he will say some things that will call our nerves. And, you know, I think at this point, it'll probably be good if Boeheim sits around for at least another year after this. Obviously there's like the 3-year timetable, but I think we all kind of know that Boeheim's going to, he'll probably be gone in those 3 years, but I don't know that we know exactly when it'll happen. So, I think we all just, I think it's a good thing that we're getting Boeheim back, not because Hopkins was like dooming the team, but because at least if Boeheim fails, then everyone's going to be like, all right, this team just sucks. Not necessarily like, oh, Hopkins is dragging everyone down.
Yeah. And you know, I said, it's not for you and I or anyone else on the site to play, you know, perspective and to set the perspective for the fan base. I don't think that's what we're doing here at all. I think, you know, and I've tried to explain this to people before. Me talking out loud on Twitter or on this podcast or on articles, a lot of it is trying to convince myself too. And if things are tough, that's to me, writing's therapeutic. Talking about the team is therapeutic because I feel like I need to, if there's things that I'm saying ultra negative, and you know what, a lot of fans probably feel the same way. You have to vent these ultra negative feelings, but then you need to be able to move past them. You can't just, you know, live and breathe them. And it's going to be a challenge, not for the fan base at large, and I think that includes us. So yeah, I don't want it to come off as, you know, we're kind of levying judgment on a fan base at all. I think we're very much part of that fan base and very much subject to the exact same feelings. Even if we get a little bit more time to hone them and shape them behind the scenes.
Oh, I mean, I've gone on more like extended Twitter rants after games with this team than I have like ever before. So I'm definitely not above getting all, you know, annoying and preachy on Twitter after games. So certainly not that.
And on that note, I think we're going to hit some halftime. Dan, what have you been drinking these last 2 weeks since it's been a while since we've spoken?
Actually had some pretty interesting stuff yesterday. Went for a couple drinks. I didn't have a full one, but I had a chance to taste Evil Twins Christmas Eve at a New York City hotel room, which is, I've come to realize that Evil Twin is really like the LCD sound system of beer breweries. Like, just really kind of weird stuff going on. A lot of it's really brilliant, some of it, you know, not so much. And also all the titles are ridiculous. This was interesting, very much a winter drink. A lot of flavors going on. Something, I don't know, I feel like it's one of those things that I don't know that I'd love to have a full like 16 ounces of it, but I had, you know, a couple ounce taste, and that was nice. I had a chance, which I, you know, one of my favorite beers that I don't get to find a lot, Boulevard's Tank 7 Farmhouse, which is wonderful, one of my favorite saisons. Popped up at a brewery that's, or not brewery, a bar that's a couple blocks away from my place, which is nice. One of my other favorite saisons, Workers' Comp from Two Roads, which is a super drinkable, kind of a lot of pale ale qualities, but, you know, some of those more dynamic saison flavors, which is nice. Had that. I don't remember if we had a podcast since I tried Ballast Point's Victory at Sea Porter, which is really good. And I'm not a big Porter fan, but really enjoyed that because Ballast Point's awesome. I'd say the most one not great one, Bronze Rye Pale Ale. Don't think I'd recommend that one. Just like super overhopped and I don't know. I really couldn't get into it. I tried This one's from Belgium. Duden Terrellis Noël, which is a Christmas beer from Belgium. It's a dark ale, 10.5%. Kind of like the, almost like the Evil Twin, a little heavier, but you have all those, like, the nutmeg, the little hint of, like, mint, like, all those Christmassy flavors. I think the Evil Twin was better. The most interesting thing that I had was yesterday from a brewery I did not know existed, and it's in, I think, Chester, New York, which is up by, like, Monroe, kind of, like, an hour north of the city, Running Duck Brewery. It's they did a beer that was supposed to kind of taste like a Samoa Girl Stout cookie. It's a brown ale. I'm going to say they did a very good job. It's kind of like very, not subtle, but not like overpowering coconut and cocoa flavors that mix pretty well. But it's also like really light on the palate, which you kind of be afraid this wouldn't be. So I really enjoyed that, like way more drinkable than a Samoa flavored turkey should, or Samoa flavored beer should be. But if you can find that anywhere, and I have no idea what their distribution's like, I had never heard of them before I saw that yesterday. Quite good. So look out for that one and a couple of those other ones. The Bronze Rye Pale Ale, not so much.
Interesting. Yeah, I know coconut's kind of like a hit or miss for people when it comes to beer. I know a bunch of people that love coconut and love coconut beer. I know plenty that don't. One of my favorite beer, well, coconut-wise, is still Death by Coconut, the a gem from Oscar Blues that I've talked about. They don't get to you, but maybe one day.
I really like coconut in general, so that was definitely, this was more up my alley, but I don't think the coconut was, like, super overpowering or super obnoxious. So, like, if you're not a huge, if you're, you know, neutral on coconut, I don't think that would rule this out. If you like Samoa cookies, I'd say definitely go for this. And I'll look for, I'm going to try to see what the distribution looks like, if I can find it. Yeah. Because I had never heard of them before at all. So, and their website looks like it was made in Microsoft Word, which is kind of a, I don't know, I kind of like it.
That's hip. I'm a fan. All right. Things that I've been drinking. Had a lot of Hop Tonic, as per usual. It's one of my favorites from over at Smog City in Torrance. Found actually a good Italian restaurant over here for once. Italian food, as one might expect in California, is not super easy to find, at least if it's good. So I had a bunch of Italian beer. I had Birra Moretti La Rosa, just their amber ale. I thought it was pretty good. Not a huge like Moretti fan, but you know what? It was a good beer. It was good with my pasta, so no complaints here. Had a Punch Bowl IPA from Abigail. Kind of stayed true to its word. Definitely was extremely juicy, tropical. Really enjoyed it. Abigail's restaurant and brewery over in Hermosa Beach. And they put out a couple good house ales as well as just some other stuff they have on tap. I had the NXS IPA, the Stone Sierra Nevada collaboration. I thought it was good. I wasn't overly thrilled with it. Which was disappointing because I do love both breweries, and I just felt like I was kind of expecting a little bit more. That might have been on me. Had Sierra Nevada's Coffee Stout, which was in their winter variety pack. Really, really good beer. I enjoyed that a ton. I'd highly recommend that for those who see it around. Just before the January 1st deadline, I had myself the Stone Enjoy By Black IPA. And that one, I thought it was just going to be like another version, well, pretty much the same thing as Sublimely Self-Righteous, which was pulled off shelves about, I think, 6 to 9 months ago. Ends up it was a much different beer. It was both lighter and hoppier, which I can always enjoy. Yeah, really, really get a lot out of that. Then I had probably one of my favorite beers recently anyway, Fourth Meal from the brewery. It's a... It was a collaboration from the brewery and Maine Beer Company. Fourth Meal, obviously playing off of, you know, Maine Beer Company's well-known IPAs, breakfast, lunch, dinner, this being Fourth Meal instead of dessert.
Is this not Taco Bell flavored? Because that's unfortunate.
Yeah, if it was Taco Bell flavored, probably would have vomited, but...
Most likely.
Most likely. Also had another brewery collaboration, Prairie Roux. It's a brewery, Prairie Artisan Ales collab. that was also, you know, easily drinkable, and that was really it. Didn't have anything like over the top, just a bunch of different things. I have a bunch in the fridge though, so I'll definitely have more to talk about in the coming weeks.
Unfortunately, now I realize that Taco Bell's going to hear this somehow, and they're going to brew a beer that's just old. What's the feature, like the one flavor they can only get out of Taco Bell?
Doritos.
The Mountain Dew.
That crap.
That Mountain Dew. The Taco Bell Mountain Dew. I'm not trying to be above Taco Bell, but Baja Blast. I love Baja Blast. It's great. It's just going to be Baja Blast and like fermented taco shells. It's going to be gross.
Yeah, it's just going to taste like liquid.
It's going to be 18% alcohol.
It's going to come in a Dorito shell.
It's a Dorito shell shot glass.
Christ.
It's still going to be better than Four Loko.
Don't get any ideas, Dan.
Don't tweet this podcast at Taco Bell. They will do it. They are crazy.
Oh, no. All right. So moving on from disgusting things. Syracuse football.
Wait, what? What did you say? Moving on from what? At least we made the Beef of Brady's Bowl.
We did make the Beef of Brady's Bowl. Thank you for that illustrious intro, Spencer, Holly, and Ryan, who described in detail a non-existent game
between public school Syracuse and Illinois, who they didn't actually talk about, I don't think, which is probably for the best.
Yeah, I mean, if I don't know anyone who'd want to talk about Bill Cubitt for more than a couple of minutes, except for Scott Schaefer.
Including the Illinois AD.
Yeah, that's if you wanted to know where the University of Syracuse is, it is the public school that played in that game. So now you know that there is a U of S, and
they went 5-7.
And they went 5-7. All right. Focusing on the actual Syracuse University football team, lots of positive things going on. I think the last week or so started with some negative news. Chris Beattie left the staff to head down to Maryland, which is, you know, kind of meh, just because A, it's Maryland, and who wants to be there? And B, you know, Beattie didn't really, he wasn't with the team for more than a couple of weeks. But understandable, he's going to be close to family. He's a lifelong DMV resident, so it makes sense that he'd want to stay in that general area. But I feel like, while it's a bummer to lose him, it has opened the door for us, you know, to grab a couple, you know, quality coaches. We have one more to go, you know, on the full-time staff. But grabbing a guy like Mike Hart and Vince Reynolds, both from Western Michigan, which was, you know, really recruiting well above their station in life these last couple of years under PJ Fleck. I think it's going to pay some huge dividends. Obviously, I'm banking on some of these big names that they're targeting paying off. But Dan, what's your kind of initial reaction on both together or one by one, however you want to look at it?
Losing Beattie sucks. I think he was probably the guy that we all got excited about. He had the, you know, really good reputation, as a recruiter, as a coach, you know, big time. And I'm just happy that we got to hold on to Ruff, who apparently, Nick Monroe is actually the main recruiter for, because Nick Monroe is the main recruiter for everyone. So that was unfortunate. But, you know, being Syracuse, you know, we have specific challenges that not every school has to face. This is one of them. It's not the first time it's happened. If you guys think back to the don't think it was the first Doug Marrone year. I think it was going into year two. He was bringing in Roger Harriott, who was a high school coach in Florida. And after, like, literally after, like, a day after signing day, Harriott, his wife came up, and they're like, yeah, no. And they flew back to Florida. And then we hired Ty Wheatley, who was, like, our best recruiter forever. So I don't know that exact thing is going to happen again. And, you know, Beattie was supposedly coaching outside receivers. We bring in another Michigan running back, Mike Hart, like we did with Wheatley, who was coaching running back. So I don't think it's like a direct correlation, but it does seem like, you know, you can make the connections there. But as for the two guys that we brought in since, I'm very excited. Hart obviously has the connection to Syracuse. If you bring up Mike Hart and any Syracuse fan that was around like in the early 2000s, they get so upset they didn't come here. And obviously he went on to be a record breaker at Michigan. He's like a, you know, he's a name guy. He's a legitimate college football superstar. He was a, and he's from Syracuse. You know, I saw some people saying, you know, why didn't, if he didn't choose Syracuse. I was going to sell it. Like, that's, you know, that's ridiculous. You just can't check off every box like that. The fact that the guy's from here, knows the area, it's his hometown, it's a nice step up, and it wasn't like we just poached him from running clinics somewhere. Like, he had coached at Eastern Michigan, then he coached at Western Michigan, which has been one of the three or four best MAC schools for a couple of years now. He coached under PJ Fleck, who is a recruiting, like, wizard. That's
also
good.
Crazy.
He's a crazy person.
Insane individual. If anyone saw the gif of him after the Bahamas Bowl, he literally is out of his mind probably 90% of his existence.
He's like lovably, legitimately insane. I enjoy the story from back when Grantland was still a thing. Holly Anderson wrote a story about him where, after the story, he gave her as a gift an oar. Which was like autographed something like Elite Interview or something, which is amazing. He's a crazy person, but he's, you know, he's very likable and he recruits incredibly well. So hopefully with our two new Western Michigan assistants, Vince Reynolds and Mike Hart, that's rubbed off. Vince Reynolds was on a top 10 list. I enjoy that we all did the, not all of us, but like a lot of the people who tweeted about it when he got hired, did the whole thing where we leave out like a keyword, where he was named one of the 10 best non-Power 5 recruiters in the country, and everyone just said one of the 10 best recruiters. So hopefully that's true. Either way, he was like one of the best recruiters on PJ Fleck's really, really good recruiting staff. So that's a good sign. And yeah, they're all MAC guys. It's fine. Like we said before, there's a difference between Schaefer going and just kind of getting guys he's friendly with who he hasn't coached as a, you know, contained unit with. I mean, they'd all coached together before, but they were never, none of them was the head guy. They hadn't organized their staff, but, you know, within their ranks. Dino Babers, coached, probably inherited a lot of these guys, and he hired them for his staff without knowing them, you know, as best buddies at Eastern Illinois or at Western, or at Central Michigan, or not Central Michigan, Bowling Green, sorry. So, like, he knows these guys can work within his staff. And obviously Mike Hart and Vince Reynolds are two outside guys. They're MAC guys as well, but they're guys that I think are very high upside and probably would have been moving on to P5, Power 5 jobs soon anyway. So that's Lewis Beattie. I don't think these two are like plug and play, better, worse, whatever. We don't really know. But at the same time, I think we got two very promising guys. And I think getting a guy like Mike Hart in the program, who is definitely a name in the Syracuse community and nationally, always has some benefits.
Yeah, you know what? And I think it's interesting. In general, I think they're on different ends of the spectrum. I think Reynolds was a rising name, and one that really did help Fleck do what he's been doing. I think it's allowed Western Michigan to be in play for a lot of big names in the state. And you know, that's been huge. And I think it's something that could definitely pay off for SU. I know in a couple different articles, I ID'd a few Michigan kids who Reynolds and Hart could potentially help us out with. And yeah, I think Reynolds was going to be headed for a Power 5 job with or without Syracuse. Hart, on the other hand, I think would have been eventually. I think that this might accelerate that path a little bit, but that's not a bad thing either. You know, Hart's a name. He, like Tyrone Wheatley, was probably bound for Michigan eventually, or at least a similar job. And I think, you know, if Syracuse, like, you know what? A lot of these guys, yes, they have maybe 10 years of experience max, but they're guys who've had results, and they've had results as a cohesive unit under Babers. And that's the important distinction to make versus the Schaefer hires. And it's not to shit all over the Schaefer hires either. Some of them worked out. Some of them were fine. A couple of them already have jobs elsewhere at Power Conference schools, so that's great. But, you know, what you have with Hart is if he's the only one you're really taking a risk on out of a full staff of nine, to me, that's perfectly fine. Is that an important position? And it was strategic. It wasn't just that, like, oh, well, here's a guy who set some records at Michigan. This is a guy who set some records at Michigan and was also the greatest running back Central New York's ever seen. You know, I mean, numbers-wise, at least. Some might have other things to say about that. But point is that this was a well-researched and you know, well-informed hire, and it's one that could pay dividends. I mean, again, looked at the article yesterday, where, you know, guys that at Hart could absolutely, you know, have some kind of influence on. I mean, he did a really nice job with the guys that were on campus at Western Michigan already. You know, he attracted Matt Falcon, a guy who, yes, had a knee injury, but still had offers and has offers in hand from most of the country's, you know, top non-SEC schools. So he had an Oregon offer, a bunch from most of the Big Ten, a lot of the ACC. And yeah, I think, you know, Falcon, he's not completely on board yet over there. Could be a guy that flips if we want to take a little bit of a gamble on someone with a knee issue that, you know, that age. Emmanuel Jackson's another three-star running back from the area and another guy that, you know, could potentially flip. And then, you know, there's the big fish everyone's been talking about. And funny enough, Moran's not even as highly rated by most services as Falcon is. But, you know, Kendrell Moran, he's over at Illinois. The previous staff was pursuing him, and this one is too. Seems like Moran's really intrigued by the Babers hire and the staff he's put together. So I think, yeah, you know what, if Hart can get more out of our running backs than we've gotten in the last few years, it seems like we've taken a huge step back in that department after a really nice, like, 5 or 6 year run of quality backs. I think that's a success. And you know what, again, like, you can take a risk on a guy that you don't have to overpay, but you know you're going to get a ton of results out of, and even if he leaves in 3 years, he's going to leave you better off for it. Schaefer's entire staff was that, by and large, and in this case, you have one guy out of nine who's that, and I think that that's perfectly okay, and you know, I'm totally fine with it, and I'm sure you are too.
Yeah, and while you were going there, I was kind of looking it up because to kind of illustrate the point of what the Western Michigan coaches have been a part of. PJ Fleck was hired at the very end of 2012. In 2013, he had limited time to put together a recruiting class. His class, based on 24/7's composite rankings, was ranked 112th in the country. So, you know, recruiting rankings, we talk about them all the time. They're, you know, not the greatest thing in the world, but they are what we have. So in 2014, his first full class, his class ranked 72nd, so a very big jump, and was the best class in the MAC by, like, they basically recruited at a different level than the rest of the MAC. Like, they were recruiting at, like, you know, consistent with a lot of the better mid-major group of five teams, and everyone else in the MAC was a whole, like, step behind. 2015, down to 76, but same range. Also, again, not quite as big a gap, but once again, the best class in the MAC. And then 2016, right now, their class is ranked 55th in the country, ahead of BYU. I'm directly ahead of Vanderbilt, Missouri, Boston College, Illinois, Boise State, Rutgers, us, Iowa State, Georgia Tech, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And once again, giant gulf between them and Miami of Ohio and the MAC. So, like, this team, you know, Western Michigan's a MAC team for sure. They weren't, like, the best MAC team every year, but they were, you know, in the top of the league. But recruiting-wise, they were basically recruiting like they were in a better conference than they were. So, obviously, that conference isn't the ACC, but, you know, you're approaching two really young assistants who kind of know the secrets that whatever PJ Fleck is doing over there. So I feel pretty good about this.
Right. And you know what? Again, it's not to assign these guys as miracle workers. It's not to say they're better than Beattie. It's not to say that they're the best recruiters we have. It's just to say that these are two guys who've been getting it done at Western Michigan, a place that shouldn't really be that easy to get it done at. And, you know, at worst, they help Syracuse, you know, pick up some of those quality three-star guys in the state of Michigan that the Broncos were getting, and potentially get, you know, their name in the ring with some of these four-star guys in the state of Michigan that were started talking to them and then maybe, you know, just headed elsewhere because they wanted more name cachet. Like, there's a lot to like. And again, these guys aren't miracle workers. It doesn't mean that suddenly we're going to get every 4- and 5-star recruit at the state of Michigan or every 4- and 5-star running back. But it does mean that we stand a better chance than we did before at attracting quality running back talents in the Northeast and Midwest. And it means that we have a better shot than we did before at locking down some better Michigan prospects. Those two things can't be underrated, and to me, they seem like a nice net win.
Right, and there's no, like, inherent advantage that Western Michigan has over the rest of the MAC. I mean, for a long time, they're just kind of an also-ran, except that B.J. Fleck, his bloodstream is like 10% Adderall, so he doesn't sleep. But like whatever they're doing there works to a like really big degree in recruiting, because it's not like they have these inherent advantages. I think overall, you know, losing the one guy that had all the Power 5 experience sucks, but I think Favors recovered pretty well, and we still have a hire to know, so we don't know how he's going to replace that. I think this last hire is the one that will, I mean, if they go the same route with the outside receivers coach, is the one that will actually kind of replace Beattie. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. There's still the coaching convention to come up. So we're actually kind of ahead of the game, because a lot of the time you don't fill those last couple spots until this, and we only have one to go. So he can really focus fire on like exactly what he wants here.
Yeah, you know, admittedly, I was kind of expecting us to wait for that. And, I mean, I'm really glad we didn't, because I feel like we're getting a jump on things before the quiet period. For those who don't realize, the AFCA, the American Football Coaches of America, meets from, what is it, the 10th to the 13th? It's like right around the national championship and all that. That timing works out, and it actually wraps up the day before the quiet period ends, and we kind of, you know, run full bore toward National Signing Day in early February. Everyone tries to have the staff completely locked up by the end of that that conference. That way, you know, again, you have a month to pretty much go balls to the wall and make sure you have your class locked up and start flipping anybody. So, you know, I think a lot of us, after Beattie left, would probably have expected us to have at least two spots open going into the AFCA event. The fact that we only have one and might have none, depending on how or where Babers moves, I think is awesome. I'm for once really, really looking forward to National Signing Day, because I feel like while we're not going to be sitting around with, you know, five-star kids grabbing Syracuse hats off a table or anything like that, I think in the weeks leading up to signing day, we're going to have a lot of surprises and a lot of nice momentum for, you know, even if the class finishes around where it did last year, if it finishes somewhere between 50 and 60, I'm totally fine with it. Because you know what? And I guess this will lead into the last point before we wrap up. This staff is very content with, you know, doing what it can and you know, trying for big names and shooting for big names, but making sure that they have a plan B and C in place if they don't work out. And I think that that's something that didn't work out for Syracuse in the past. You had either a high three or a four-star kid at every year with Schaefer that didn't make it to campus. And I think that, you know, this new staff is also targeting four stars, but they want to make sure that plan is also backfilled. And I think you saw it a little bit already with a guy like Sadiq Palmer, who was, you know, he was a three-star, he's a quality receiver out of New Jersey, but as soon as they saw that he was in danger of, you know, some academic qualifying issues, they kind of had to move on and focus their attention elsewhere. And it's not to say that Palmer's a bad kid. He's not. It's not to say that the kid we definitely get is 100% better than Palmer will be, but it's to say that, you know, this is a program that understands the recruiting cycle and how to set yourself up for success.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about depth issues with the basketball team. I mean, we've seen very similar ones with the football team for a while now. When Moreau took over, obviously he went on that like campaign of weeding people out and kids, you know, if they didn't get cut, they got like an urge to leave. And he didn't really almost get a full roster until his final year. And then obviously kids left and there was a lot of overturn when Schaefer took over, and we had some of the same issues. And I mean, the last 2 years we saw with all the injuries, there were, you know, we had walk-ons playing in certain spots. We went through all these quarterbacks. So, I always was generally okay with the, and Marone did the same thing as Schaefer, strategy of kind of taking risks on high upside kids who might have like an academic risk here and there and hoping it worked out. Unfortunately, we got burned by it a number of times. And then you had a situation with Blair last year where we were kind of betting on him to be the starter. And I think you can take risks on kids like that, but you also need to like have a plan and a good contingency. You almost have to like bet on them not being here. And then if they are, it's a bonus. And with Schaefer at times, I feel like it was the other way around where it's like, all right, well, this kid will work out for sure. We're getting all these good reports. Putting your faith in the NCAA to clear someone is not good. It's not a good plan. So even if we're mad about, you know, the system and how everyone gets screwed over, like, we're, you know, in both sports, we know the NCAA will screw people over, so let's not put it up to them.
Completely agree. So I guess the last question before we go. Dan, I know you saw that we did, and everyone listening saw that we did the very, very early depth chart projections for both the offense and defense. Obviously, we're about 240-plus days out, or just around 240 days out, from kickoff against Colgate. Dan, is there anything that stuck out to you is just not in line with your thinking in terms of either depth chart? Do you think both kind of fall in line? Do you see, I mean, obviously this is based on very little that we have inside knowledge and more based on assumption. Do you think there are any names on there that, or ones that weren't on there that speak out to you as maybe a guy who could be a great fit for what Babers is trying to do?
I'm kind of refreshing myself here. I'm interested to see, we have Ben Lewis kind of penciled in as like a slot receiver, running back. I'm interested to see where they put him. I think he's a very useful player in the right role, but especially as like a blocker, he's probably, and that's important in the Babers offense with so many screens. So I do think he'll be utilized. I'm not sure exactly where. And I think the biggest mystery is offensive line. Like, that's, we have obviously had issues there this year. We only have a couple seniors returning, and really only like Amari Palmer has a ton of experience. Other guys were going in and out. So, but I don't know that I would totally like outright disagree with anything. I am interested to see how Irv Phillips is used. I know there's like an interesting like schism between Syracuse fans as to where they like him. I thought he was so good as running back and looked so natural that I want to see him getting carries out of the backfield. Other people, you know, like a skill set at receiver. I just don't know if he had the natural hands for that. You guys penciled him in at running back, but obviously we have Fredericks as well. But Babers showed at Bowling Green this year that he can use two running backs very, you know, effectively, which is fun. And I think it's good for the talent that we have on the roster. And defensively, I mean, I think things look pretty good. It's very telling that we have all freshmen and sophomores on the defensive line, but that's just kind of unfortunate situation we're placed in. Hopefully, I would love to see the staff go after some JUCO guys there, if possible. Though we haven't really heard too much about that.
Yeah, I think the JUCO call is a good one, and I know Babers isn't really going to expand because he can't. But yeah, I do think that defensively, you see very much what's happened. We've loaded up on parts of, I think we've loaded up on corners and linebackers, but not necessarily safeties. You see a lot of freshmen, but on the bright side there, with the line, is you see a lot of sophomores and you see a lot of, you know, redshirt sophomores or redshirt freshmen. So these are guys that have at least spent a year or two now in a college weight room and in a college strength and conditioning program. And I think that's a positive that, you know, we might not have been able to point to in other years. I think one of SU's bigger issues was that, you know, it started throwing, it was burning shirts too quickly, and it burned some shirts it probably shouldn't have last year. But it's, you definitely look at a team that seems better equipped to refresh talent and build depth now. And I mean, they're still not there, still haven't built that depth, but they're, again, better equipped for it. The Irv Phillips point's interesting. Like I said in the article, I was the only one to put Phillips at starting running back. I don't think that distinction is a sense of superiority over Fredericks. I think no matter which one of them gets more carries, and by more carries, I mean one gets 17, the other gets 13. They're going to be a lot of between the tackles running. I think Phillips showed a penchant for being able to do that very well. I know, obviously, his skill set might lend to more outside runs, but you're not going to see a ton of those. In Babers' offense, it's a lot of between the tackles runs that pull in the defense and then allow for screens to work. And you know what? I think the two of them would be very similar to what Bowling Green had. I mean, I know in the MAC championship game breakdown, I did a kind of comparison of this person equals this person, as in this Falcons player equals this Orange player, and I think that probably holds for anyone looking to make further comparisons. You have two different style of running backs. I think Fredericks has nice bursts of speed, but I think the fat back label means that he can probably, you know, I guess, put a little more muscle behind it, versus Phillips is just a really quick and not even shifty guy, because that's not the right word for him. He's just a really speedy, quick burst, you know, running back. And you saw it later in the year when we started giving him handoffs again. You know, the guy was electric out of the backfield, much better than I think when they were using him in the mid-range passing game and he just couldn't pull in the ball. Yeah, I definitely would like to see him getting a good deal of carries, and I'm sure Babers already knows that and is going to use him there. But yeah, this is going to be interesting. I think there's going to be a couple kids that surprise. You know, you never know what happens to a guy like Kentarius Womack or, you know, any number of other kids who were freshmen last year or sophomores last year and are kind of buried beneath some experience right now. But they're guys that Babers, because he doesn't have these sacred cows and doesn't have these guys that he feels like he needs to be beholden to, that could potentially work the way up in the depth chart very quickly through spring ball.
Yeah, I like, more than a lot of things right now in terms of my sports life, I wish I could just go and, like, sit down with Dino and listen to him talk about the players that on the team, like, now that I assume he's had a chance to watch some film. Like, I'm just so interested to see what he thinks about the guys. Like, because obviously the last 2 years haven't been good, but I think we're all pretty bullish on a number of players in this team. Dungy, Fredericks, Phillips, Steve Ishmael, who we didn't bring up because questioning his position on the team is stupid. like, there are so many really interesting talents in this team. I'm so interested to see and hear how Babers plans to use them and what he thinks about them and where he thinks the improvement is. And unfortunately, when he did his like little media junket, he hadn't seen very much of the team at all, which is understandable. He had a bowl game, you know, he had a championship to win, and he did. So I look forward to hopefully getting, you know, hopefully we hear some of that in spring. Hopefully he's a little more forthcoming than our last couple coaches. Although, you know, at this point I'm all in on Babers, so he could, you know, give us absolutely nothing, and I'd find I'd find, you know, reason to be happy about that. But yeah, I think we're all looking forward to spring ball based on this, how these last two seasons have gone. I mean, I'm in the point right now where it looks like my next team that, you know, has some hope going on is the Mets, and, you know, we were just in the World Series, it feels like, and the Mets don't start it in for a couple months, so it could be a long couple sports months for me here.
Yeah, you know, I'm the same way, except I am a Knicks fan, so I suddenly have things to really believe in, which is weird. But, yeah, I think Syracuse football is becoming this. I was talking to my my best friend from college this morning, and, you know, we were saying it's really, really weird to have more faith in the not just short-term future of Syracuse football over basketball, but long-term future too. That's not to knock Hopkins or SU basketball. It's just a state fact. Like, right now, the excitement is kind of palpable around the football team. Hopefully that, you know, translates to attendance in the fall and maybe some additional excitement and conversation during spring ball. But I think, you know, that this is an exciting time for football. It's weird saying that coming off of, you know, two straight non-bowl seasons, but there's a lot to like, and, you know, again, hopefully we close out this recruiting period strong and we can really start, you know, diving into the roster in earnest. I know we are in the middle of basketball season, and obviously if things turn around, we're going to have more basketball talk, but for the time being, I mean, you and I are definitely heavier on the football side, and as long as there's things to talk about there, I'm happy to do it for as long as we want to.
Yep, and ain't nobody ever lost signing day, as they say, so it's like, Lord help us if Babers doesn't have a good first nine games, though. Like, I'm just saying that, like, based on Hopkins, who everyone's been, like, so happy about for 20 years, like, he's been everyone's best friend on the basketball program, and he has nine games that, you know, maybe won't even define the season, that, and he loses five of them, and people freak out. So let's hope Dino's first nine games, obviously 4-5, I think we'd, you know, maybe be okay with, because based on the sport, but, oh, God. Hopefully we can give him a little more rope.
I was going to say, I think I'd be okay with 4-5 to start Babers' career.
Yeah. But Babers starts like 2-7. Oh, my God. He didn't even have 20 years of being a, you know, loyal Syracusan behind him.
And on that note, I think we can wrap up. Dan, thanks as always for joining.
Yes. Thank you. I'm glad we got off the Schneider, the vacation hiatus we took.
Yeah, when you record on Wednesday nights and holidays happen to fall on Thursdays, gets a little tough, but we managed to pull it off. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. Thanks for listening. This is Troy Nunes and Absolute Podcast. We'll be back next week, hopefully talking positively about a Syracuse basketball team on the upswing.
No, it'll just be, oh, Boeheim is so good, we have to fire Hopkins.
And on that note, go Orange.
Go Mike Piazza.